Welcome to the CIL podcast series by the Centre for International Law at the National University of Singapore. You'll find the full range of our audio and video podcast materials at our website, cil.nus.edu.sg.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Tara Davenport, and I'm a researcher at the Centre for International Law at the National University of Singapore. I am delighted to have here with us today Professor Tommy Koh, Ambassador at Large of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Chairman of the Governing Board of the Centre for International Law, also known as CIL. I'm sure Prof. Koh needs no introduction, but for those of you who may not know, Prof. Koh has had a long and distinguished career. He was the President of the Third United Nations Conference on the Law of the Sea and chaired the Preparatory Committee and the Main Committee at the Earth Summit. He has also been Singapore's permanent representative to the United Nations, Ambassador to the United States, Canada, and Mexico, and he has also acted as Singapore's agent in the case concerning Pedro Branca before the International Court of Justice, as well as in the land reclamation case in the International Tribunal for the Law of the Sea. Now, I've had the privilege of meeting Prof. Koh 10 years ago when CIL was first established, and I think that he has inspired a whole generation of Law of the Sea scholars and government officials. Today, we will be talking to Prof. Koh about his experiences at the Third United Nations Conference on the Law of the Sea, which led to the 1982 UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, also known as UNCLOS, his recent book, Building a New Legal Order for the Oceans, and his views on contemporary challenges that oceans governance face today. For the uninitiated, could you please explain how you got involved in the negotiations in the Third Conference and the circumstances that led you to being elected as president?
In my first tenure as permanent representative to the United Nations, I saw that countries were seeking consensus to launch a major exercise in negotiating and adopting a new law of the sea. Because the sea is vital to Singapore's well-being and livelihood, I wrote a memorandum to the then Prime Minister, Mr. Lee Kuan Yew, and convinced him that this is one conference we must participate in. You know, he agreed. And so three of us, Professor Jayakumar, Judge Chao Hik Tin, and I, represented Singapore first in a seabed committee and then the conference itself.
Okay. Interesting. And was that one of the first few negotiations that Singapore participated in?
Yes, first one of the few major negotiations.
Okay. What were the most important issues to Singapore at that time?
We wanted to preserve our status as an international port to ensure that ships can sail to the port and leave the port and that the passage is free and safe. We wanted to make sure that claims that were being made by our neighbours would not impinge on our vital national interests. We wanted to just replace the state of chaos in the world with legal order, you know.
And freedom of navigation, of course, was very important, right? Particularly because of the extensive claims of archipelagic waters. And
I think by the commencement of the conference, it was clear that the old legal rule of 3 mile territorial sea was no longer tenable.
Yeah.
And there was a movement to 12 mile territorial sea. This will, however, made many international straits into straits with territorial waters in them. And we wanted to make sure that there was a special regime of passage to the Straits of Malacca and Singapore.
And was it, I guess, challenging because you were sort of, you know, that's the beginning of ASEAN, was it sort of challenging, sort of breaking from the shared common position of Indonesia and Malaysia on the straits?
Not really, because on some issues we make common cause, on other issues we differ, but we agree to disagree in a very pleasant way.
Okay, that's very interesting. And what were the challenges that Singapore, like as a small, newly independent state, faced during these huge multilateral negotiations?
Well, first we lacked experience, and there were very few international lawyers.
How old were you when you went?
We began, I was in my 30s.
But you had already been dean of the law school. Yeah. That's amazing.
So we lack experience, we lack people, and we didn't have any great ambition. We just wanted to safeguard our interests, play a constructive role in the conference, help to bring about agreement.
Yeah.
So seeking the leadership of the conference is the last thing on our minds.
Yeah. And then how did that happen?
Well, first I'll give you one historical trivia.
Mm-hmm.
I think people will be surprised to learn that the presidents of the first, second, and third UN conference on the law of the sea were all Asians.
Oh.
Yeah.
I didn't know that actually.
The president of the first and second UN conference on the law of the sea was a Thai.
Oh.
Prince Wan of Thailand.
Really? Yeah.
And in the case of the third conference, there were two Asian presidents, Shirley and Mara Singh of Sri Lanka and myself.
Yeah.
So it's just a historical accident that the four leaders of the three UN conferences on the law of the sea were all Asians.
I actually never realized that. Oh, that's so interesting.
So, Shirley Amarasinghe was a very charismatic individual. He was chairman of the seabed committee.
Yeah.
So when we began the conference, he automatically became president of the conference, although he's not a lawyer. He wasn't a lawyer. But in the United Nations, some very well-informed individuals are able to contribute to legal discussion, even though they're not legally trained. So Shirley was one of them. Then in 1980, he died suddenly.
Oh.
Yeah. Mm. And he died in a very romantic way.
Oh.
Yeah. He suffered a heart attack while playing tennis with his German girlfriend.
Oh.
So the Asian group had a very difficult time agreeing on a single candidate. The reason was that there were two equally good candidates who wanted to succeed Shirley. Mm-hmm. And they were Ambassador Satyananda from Fiji and Ambassador Christopher Pinto from Sri Lanka.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
And after many months, they could still agree on who should concede to whom. And in the meantime, the Latin American group threatened us that if the Asian group is unable to produce a candidate, then they won the presidency of the conference.
Oh.
So this caused alarm to the Asian group.
Yeah.
And the Asian group then asked the leader of the Indonesian delegation, the foreign minister, Pak Mokhtar Kusuma Atmaja, to play a role as the good officers and see whether he can bring out some resolution, you know. So Pak Mokhtar did a straw poll of the Asian group, and to his unhappy surprise, he found that Satya and Chris had more or less equal support.
Oh, no. You know?
So he appealed to both of them to say, in the interest of the Asian group and the conference, one of them should concede to the other. But neither would do so.
Oh.
Yeah. He then asked them this strange question, whether they would withdraw in favor of the third candidate.
Oh.
And they both said they would withdraw, provided I'm willing to serve.
Oh.
You know? So I was not a candidate, I was drafted by the Asian group. So when Pak Mokhtar told me the news, I was quite astounded and said, can you please call my minister in Singapore and explain that I didn't seek this and that the Asian group is asking me to please come to the rescue and become the president of the conference. That's what ends the story.
I never actually knew that. Yeah, that's so interesting. What was your most memorable experience throughout the whole 9 years? I know there must be many. Maybe a difficult question.
Oh, there are many.
Yeah.
Because it lasted so long,
yeah,
it became like a club, you know?
Yes.
And you form friendships that last for life.
Yeah.
So some of my happy memories were that there were good friends from different parts of the world,
mm-hmm.
who were very good lawyer,
yeah.
good negotiator, good draftsman.
Mm.
And it was this collection of good people that finally produced the convention.
Yeah.
Another memory is that we were very innovative in terms of procedures.
Yeah.
Yeah. If the formal processes and negotiation were not fruitful, then individual leaders at the conference would take a personal initiative and convene a small informal negotiating group to bring out some productive outcome. So Judge Jens Evensen of Norway, he convened a group which produced basically the articles on the exclusive economic zone.
Yeah.
The leader of the Mexican delegation who became Foreign Minister Jorge Castaneda, he convened a group to settle the very difficult issue of the status of the exclusive economic zone.
Yes.
That was due to Castaneda's good work.
Yeah.
Then Fiji and the United Kingdom convened a small negotiating group on straits.
Yeah.
You know? And it was this group of 11 countries meeting privately day after day, night after night, that produced the articles you now find in a convention.
Yeah.
You know? So there were these informal processes. There were leaders at the conference who took an initiative and break the impasse at the conference.
And do you think that these informal groups were critical, right, to the success?
Oh, absolutely.
But were there any disadvantages to it, though?
Of course. They were not democratic.
Oh.
You know? Because the membership was by invitation.
No.
And in each case, the group was very small.
Yeah.
Just a dozen or so delegations and leaders. You know. So that process cannot be replicated today.
It
would be shut down at not being inclusive. It would be shut down at not being democratic.
And transparent as well.
And not transparent.
Yes. Yeah. But it was really helpful in terms of basically,
And we were quite desperate, you know, that we couldn't just go on meeting session after session, year after year, with no result.
Yeah.
You know?
Yes.
But I think one of the most important decisions made in a conference was in 1975.
Mm-hmm.
Could I tell you about
Yes,
that?
Please.
In 1975, we were meeting in Geneva.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? Ambassador Satyanandan and I both came to the conclusion that we were floundering.
Mm-hmm.
We were getting nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
And that what we desperately needed was a single negotiating text.
Mm-hmm.
So the two of us agreed that I will make the proposal to the conference to request the chairman of the three main committee to draft treaty articles, which would then be, you know, put together as a single negotiating text. We were not sure whether the conference was prepared to take the step and invest so much responsibility and power in the three channels. But I guess people felt the need, you know, and I seized the right moment. So to our happy surprise, the conference agreed. So the three chairmen were asked to draft treaty articles. Then something very strange happened. The chairman of the second committee met with an accident.
He
was quite short-sighted and walking along the corridor at the UN premises in Geneva, he didn't see that there was a glass door in front of him.
Oh dear.
So he walked into a glass door which crashed and it injured his eyes.
Oh my goodness.
So he was hospitalized and he then asked his rapporteur, Satyanandan, whether Satyanandan could prepare the draft treaty articles on his behalf.
Oh.
That's how Satya got involved, you know, in a very pivotal way in the work of the conference.
Yeah. And this was the second committee, did you say, or the first, the second committee?
No, second.
Second committee, yeah.
Second committee, which is the most important because it deals with territorial sea, high sea, archipelago, straits, and so on, you know?
Yeah, the bulk of the,
Okay. And Satya did it in the evening when the conference were not meeting.
Oh.
Yeah. And he had the help of only one person, a very young member of the secretariat from Finland.
Oh.
Yeah. Mm. His name is Gottmandal Eriksson.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm. And the two of them, working night after night, managed to produce a very good text, you know.
Yeah. No, it is. I mean, it's incredible, actually.
So the conference had many, you know, interesting events, coincidences, individuals who came to the fore, you know, when given responsibility.
Yeah. I think you've written about that in your book, about how it was really down to a lot of influential and important individuals, right, that, you know, led to the convention. What about the interest groups? So not the informal negotiating groups, but like the Group of 77 and the Coastal State groups.
Yeah.
Was that helpful or unhelpful?
Well, there were different kinds of groups.
Yes.
Yeah? First, you had the regional groups, which were composed along geographical lines.
Mm-hmm.
So the Asian group, African group, Latin American group, Western European and others group, Eastern European group.
Yeah.
Then you have the interest group.
Yeah.
And the biggest interest group was called the Group of 77.
Yeah.
These are the developing countries,
mm-hmm.
you know. But as the conference progressed, delegation realized that these groups do not speak for them.
No.
And they need to find common cause with other countries that share their interests.
Okay.
So this led to the formation of many groups, the coastal groups, countries with broad continental shelves. Then Singapore was responsible for forming one group called the Group of Landlocked and Geographically Disadvantaged States. The reason we formed this group is that nobody's listening to us.
Mm.
You know, as long as you are few and you are not powerful, nobody will listen to you.
Yeah.
So we felt that if we could form a group that constituted a third of the conference, then that gives us power.
Yeah.
You know, so we made common cause with the landlocked countries and other countries which, although coastal, were situated in such a way that they could not claim extensive maritime zones, you know. And that was one group that we formed.
Yeah. And that sort of formed organically, or you went around and talked to different...
Oh, no, we talked to individual countries.
Okay.
So, because you had this complexity of interest group, then on top of that, the conference constituted negotiating groups, you know.
Yeah, so...
So there were many groups.
Yes.
And then on top of the formal negotiating group, you have all these informal negotiating groups.
Yeah.
So there was a huge complexity hierarchy of,
yes.
of groups. So,
but it's interesting because it's so, but they managed to, I guess, work and give their comments on the single negotiating text, and then it just grew from there.
Yeah.
Okay.
And in a way, without these interest groups, it would have been even more difficult to negotiate and resolve the difficult issues before the country.
Yeah. You talk a lot in your book about the value that NGOs played in UNCLOS. Could you please tell us about how they played a role in negotiations?
I guess coming from academia and culturally not hostile to non-governmental organizations.
Yeah.
In fact, some of my good friends are NGO leaders.
Yes.
And so I had a very positive attitude towards the NGOs.
Okay.
And I asked them to render some valuable services to the conference. Mm-hmm. For example, they group themselves and call themselves the Neptune Group.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
And they published a daily bulletin,
okay.
which was a very good and accurate record of what was going on each day.
Yeah.
You know, and so many delegations would collect this bulletin, which becomes a report to their capital.
Okay.
Then I also asked them to play a different role for me. I said, I want to level the playing field between the developed and developing countries. Many developing countries lack technical knowledge, you know, and they are negotiating at a disadvantage. So I asked the NGOs to arrange some weekend retreats at which they will bring specialists to tell us about, for example, the continental shelf and the continental margin, you know, and how far out to sea it would be reasonable or not unreasonable for coastal state to claim rights to the shelves, you know.
Yeah.
I would bring experts to explain about the different kind of fish, because most conference delegations are not experts in fishery, and they would not understand the different kinds of fish we were dealing with, you know. Or talk about, asked them to bring experts to explain to us about hydrocarbons, in continental shelves. So in these ways, they render very valuable service to the country.
And did you have sort of a, for yourself and for the presidents, like sort of scientists helping you and advising you, like a designated, What was your reaction when the United States and other maritime states decided in 1980, to... to not to ratify the convention.
No, the story began in 1980.
Yes.
Yeah, with the election of Ronald Reagan as the new president of the United States.
Yeah.
You should understand something. Before President Reagan, the United States, whether led by the Democrats or Republicans, subscribed to a common ocean policy.
Yeah.
I think it went all the way back to Nixon. and subsequent administration, whether Republican or Democrat, adhere to that ocean policy. Because it basically takes care of American national interests. So we did not expect that with the election of a new Republican president, there would be a drastic change in the U.S. attitude towards the ocean policy. But President Reagan was, in a sense, a revolutionary, and hardcore nationalist. So when he was elected, he asked for a complete review of U.S. ocean policy. He asked the United States government to do a review of what the conference had produced and how the United States should position itself vis-a-vis them. The part of the draft convention that rankles with the Reagan administration was Part 11 on the deep seabed and ocean floor. So they asked us to give them time to do their review. We gave them time. So when they came back, they demanded very extensive changes to Part 11 of the draft convention. The amendments are so numerous that they were in a book. And as the book had a green cover, we referred to it as a green book. I felt that, and I asked the developing country, are you willing to negotiate with the United States on the basis of that green book? They said no. That Americans were not acting in good faith, that this is not acceptable. So what I did to break this impasse, I asked 12 small and medium-sized countries to come together, group of 12, consisting of the Scandinavian country, Australia, Canada, New Zealand, and some others, and asked them whether they could try to play a mediating role. I asked them to study the amendments in the Green Book, talk to the developing country, and come up with some suggested amendment that could bridge this gap, And they did not fail me, although the time was very short. They came up with a set of amendments which were quite promising. Actually, I took them to the developing country and said, this is produced by this group of 12, convened at my request. If you are willing to accept them, I think there's a chance that the United States could accept them. And if it could accept them, then this was the basis of a compromise. I was very sad when the United States told me that they couldn't accept this amendment. And then an inexplicable thing happened after the United States had voted against the convention. In the explanation of vote, the United States said, if the amendment proposed by the group of 12 had been incorporated, they would not have voted against it. I couldn't believe what I heard, And I asked myself, how can you say that when a few days ago you rejected those same proposals? So I was very confused. Still not clear today whether the statement made was not made in good faith or whether they had made a mistake in so abruptly rejecting this amendment. Before the vote, I had to consider very seriously whether to put the convention to the vote. As you know, from December 1973 down to April 1982, we had never taken a vote. Everything had been achieved by consensus. And we were very reluctant to take a vote. I asked for the advice of many countries, east and west, north and south, on whether I should give the American more time, defer, give them more time, postpone the drastic step of taking a decision. And the advice given to me, including from Western countries, including from Satya Nandan, was that we must waste no more time. And that if we give the United more time, there's a danger that we will lose all the things that we have achieved, you know. So with this advice, I decided then to proceed and to push it to the fore.
And were you at all involved in the lead up to the 1994 implementation agreement?
So, 10 years after the UN Conference on the Law of the Sea, I found myself in Rio de Janeiro, chairing the negotiation at the 1992 Earth Summit. And the outcome document, which is voluminous, is called Agenda 21. So I took advantage of that, of the Earth Summit, to include in Agenda 21 a request for the UN to convene a conference to try to find a solution to a problem that we did not resolve in a conference. And this is how to regulate, how to manage and regulate two kinds of fish. Highly migrating, highly migratory species, such as tuna, and fish that straddle several zones in their lifetime. Straddling stock. And the UN then turned to Ambassador Satyanandan to chair the conference. And he succeeded in producing an agreement, a very important agreement, really very important agreement. And then he was very clever. He thought of a way of making this part of the convention without amending the convention. So he came out with this ingenious idea of calling it an implementation agreement. First adopted by the UN General Assembly, but had to be signed and ratified. Like treaties. You know?
That was fascinating. And it took, it was quite quick, right? The 1995 and the even for part 11, the 1994 implementation agreement, it happened quite quickly. But I guess at that time, developing countries sort of were ready to let go of their hard-held positions.
Well, the world had changed.
Yeah.
The world had changed, you know? The Cold War ended. The fascination by some developing country in the past with a socialist centrally planned system was no longer fashionable. So many changes had taken place, and the developing countries were willing to be more flexible, less ideological when it came to part 11.
That's a happy ending.
Sort of.
We'd love to hear your views on the dispute settlement system in the Law of the Sea Convention.
The dispute settlement system in UNCLOS is unique and very important. When we were negotiating the treaty, many of us came to the conclusion that in order to preserve the integrity of the convention, there must be a system of compulsory dispute settlement. And it took us many years before we achieved a consensus. So part 11, part 15 of the convention is a part, it's a part of the treaty. It's not an optional protocol, you know. The point I wanted to make is that when you become a party to the convention, you have accepted the system of compulsory dispute settlement. And you can't say subsequently that you didn't ask for my consent before you took me to arbitration and I refused to participate. That is wrong. When Singapore became a party to the convention, we've given our consent. So when Malaysia took us to arbitration without our prior consent, they were right to do so. And we participated in arbitration.
You have described UNCLOS as a constitution for the oceans, or all the oceans. Why, what led you to say this?
In my concluding statement as president, I described the convention as the constitution of the oceans. I chose the word constitution deliberately. I wanted to make the point that just as the constitution is the highest law of a country, UNCLOS is the highest law on the law of the sea, you know? And it's wrong for some country to argue that, oh no, it is just one of the many sources of the law of the sea. Some country, for selfish reason, are trying to downgrade the importance of UNCLOS. The reason is that their claims and activities are not consistent with UNCLOS, so they want to downgrade the important UNCLOS. We must reject this.
Yeah.
We must all agree that UNCLOS is the highest law on the law of the sea.
And you have implementing agreements, but it's all based on UNCLOS. UNCLOS, UNCLOS will always be the framework convention,
exactly.
The umbrella, right? You talk about countries which sort of exercise their rights in a way that could be perceived as inconsistent with the Law of the Sea Convention, sort of a recent trend of countries trying to rewrite the careful compromises in the Law of the Sea Convention. I think one such example, of course, is the existence of historic rights either to all the oil and gas resources or the fisheries resources in the exclusive economic zones of states. So what are your views on that? Is it possible really now for a country to maintain its historical rights even after the adoption of UNCLOS?
I want to answer this question indirectly by giving you an example.
Yes.
Before UNCLOS, Singapore had a small fishing fleet and a fishing industry.
Yeah. Which I actually didn't know.
You didn't know?
No, yeah.
Post UNCLOS, our fishing industry disappeared.
Yeah.
Why? Because the historic fishing ground that our fishermen used to go to had become part of the exclusive economic zone of Indonesia and Malaysia.
Yeah.
You know? It is not possible for Singapore to say, hey, we've got historic rights in Indonesian and Malaysian economic zone.
Yeah.
And so, in spite of UNCLOS, these historic rights have survived.
Yeah.
This is not the correct position.
Yeah. Okay. You've said on several occasions in your book and other fora that the UNCLOS was not a North-South negotiation, nor was it a product of the West. So why do you think that some commentators believe that it was, and why do you think this is incorrect?
I think some commentators are ill-informed. Either they're ill-informed or they have some political agenda, you know. UNCLOS is a revolutionary treaty, you know. And the conference process was pushed, not by the developed country, but by the developing country, developing coastal state country. They wanted to rewrite the traditional law of the sea, make it reflect their interests and aspirations. And the convention contained so many new concepts of international law, you know. So it's totally wrong to say that UNCLOS is a product of the West or that it's a mere codification treaty.
Yeah.
It is neither, you know. It's a revolutionary treaty and it reflects the interests and aspirations of all countries, but especially the developing countries.
Yeah.
I want to address the point that some people have said the time has come to amend the convention, you know. I've heard this especially from friends from the environmental constituency. I share their interest, but my response to them is that UNCLOS has the capacity to accommodate new development. And the implementation agreement on straddling fish stock and highly migratory fish is an example of how the convention has accommodated a new development. In the same way, there's currently a conference that's seeking to come to an agreement on how to deal with biodiversity beyond the limits of national jurisdiction, BBNJ in short.
You know,
if they come to an agreement, this would be embodied in a form of an implementation agreement. So we found a creative way in which we can add to the convention without amending it.
And I think also the beauty sometimes of the Law of the Sea Convention is that the phrases are vague enough that you can interpret it in a way that accommodates these new developments. The last question is, if you know, you've had such an interesting and long career as both an international lawyer and diplomat, what advice would you give international lawyers today if they wanted to pursue a career in international law?
It is very challenging to keep faith as an international lawyer because we live in a world dominated by power politics, by the use of force, coercion by big countries to have their way, you know. And in such a state, it's hard for a young international lawyer to keep their faith. You know? So my advice to them is that We may live in a seemingly chaotic world, but it is not a lawless world. And every country, no matter how powerful, would prefer to live in a world ruled by law than in a world ruled by force. Yeah? And therefore, the world will always need rules, laws, principle. You know? And I think that we should continue to help strengthen the international order.
Yeah. You know? And this is one of the reasons why CIL was established. Well, we've come to the end of this fascinating interview in conversation with Prof. Tommy Koh. Thank you so much, Prof. It's been really interesting. I think the people listening in found it very fascinating, and I think our audience will find it very, very interesting. So thank you very much for your time. So if you'd like to find out more about some of the topics we discussed in the interview, please do read Prof. Koh's new book, Building a New Legal Order for the Oceans. It's a compilation of some of his academic articles and reflections on the law of the sea, and it's a fascinating read.
Thanks for listening today. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review and share it with friends. The full range of our audio and video podcasts, as well as our blog, our research and activities, can be found on our website at cil.nus.edu.sg.